in-depth look at Israel, the number one global nuclear renegade. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. We're joined now by Grant F. Smith, and we're going to be talking about Israel and nuclear weapons. That's not something that most people spend any time talking about, particularly at the United Nations and around the world in terms of who's building weapons and what kind of responsibility they have for those weapons. Grant Smith, again, is the director of the Washington-based Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy. And you all introduced a lawsuit last month. Could you tell us a little bit about that lawsuit and what it has to do with Israel and nuclear weapons?
Sure, Dennis. We filed yet another in a string of Freedom of Information Act lawsuits, which we're using to try to tease out the official and mostly secret policies that have been in place in the United States about Israel's nuclear weapons. And so this particular lawsuit came on the heels of a report that was in the New Yorker by Adam Enthaus, which verified on the basis of conversations with national security advisors that every president from Bill Clinton up to the present Donald Trump has signed a secret letter promising never to pressure the Israeli government into signing the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, or even discussing the fact that Israel has nuclear weapons and a longstanding nuclear weapons program. So the sort of change theory here is a lot of the foreign aid that Congress lavishes on Israel and has done so since the Nixon administration is premised on maintaining their so-called qualitative nuclear edge. So we're raising the question, do you really need to maintain the qualitative nuclear edge of a nuclear weapons state, the only one in the region? And more important than that even is that our own Arms Export Control Act has special protocols for aid that goes to secret, clandestine, non-NPT signatory countries that must be followed by law if the U.S. is to deliver aid. And we have a Congress and a president that's been flouting that law ever since it was passed in 1976, the so-called Symington and Glenn amendments to the U.S. Arms Export Control Act.
What do we know at this point in terms of nuclear weapons in Israel? Do we know how many weapons they have? There's all kinds of estimates. They keep it very secret. What do we know about that?
Well, I like to rely on people who are probably in the know. That would include Mordecai Vanunu for sure. It would certainly include Jimmy Carter, who had access to the best U.S. intelligence and made the comments that he believed they had 200 nuclear weapons after he left office. But I think the number isn't so much important as the fact that it's widely understood that Israel has a triad, just like the United States, of submarine launchable, air launchable, missile launchable missiles, both tactical and strategic, that they can use to essentially behave in a form that most countries of its size would not be able to exert on the world scene. And there's also a great deal of thought that part of the leverage that Israel exerts, again, in the case, we're critical of leverage exerting on behalf of not wanting to ever have a settlement with the Palestinians, not wanting to engage in bona fide peace efforts. Part of the leverage that allows it not to do that is this whole nuclear infrastructure, which is kind of behind every argument for not pushing them too much.
I think it's rather extraordinary when we hear Israel threatening to attack Iran, really trying to undermine the deal, which they did actually quite well, but threatening to attack Iran and even to attack Iran with nuclear weapons if they attempt or if they in any way threaten to build a weapon. I mean, there is an incredible contradiction. This must create great rage in the region. Many countries in the region want a non-nuclear Middle East, don't they?
Right, they do, and they've been pushing, and even the Obama administration initially signaled that it would listen to them at a non-proliferation conference in the region. The Egyptians, the Saudis, the Jordanians, the Iraqis, everyone, the Iranians in the region understand that they're dealing with a nuclear state, but that the United States is unwilling to even discuss that. And I think it should also be infuriating to Americans because under a longstanding gag rule that's been in place, well, it's not that long time, since 2012, it's called WPN 136, their officials in federal agencies cannot even talk about information in the public domain, much less what the United States knows and the Department of Energy, the CIA, et cetera. They can't talk about Israel's nuclear weapons as if they're a fact that has to be dealt with. They could be fired and prosecuted if they do. And James Doyle, who was working at Los Alamos and wrote some rather benign references about Israel's nuclear weapons, faced exactly that. So we have a really, I would just say, extreme treatment of this topic, which is designed to suffocate debates, suffocate public policymaking that's informed. And you also find that the entire discussion here in Washington in the so-called non-proliferation think tanks avoids this subject entirely. And a lot of that, they would claim, is due to the paucity of information. But there are excellent researchers like Abner Cohen and Roger Mattson and others who have studied the information that's available and concluded that this is a fact that exists and should be dealt with. And for the most part, the information has no impact. It's not part of the policy debate.
What are the nuts and bolts of the lawsuit? What are you all hoping to gain? What kinds of information are you looking for?
Well, it's very simple and very precise. We have asked for the first two letters, one that Bill Clinton signed, again, guaranteeing that he wouldn't raise the NPT, or pressure the Israelis by discussing their nuclear weapons program, and the one signed by George W. Bush. The only ones who have all four letters at this point that we know of, according to the article, are the Israelis. And we think the American public should have copies of those letters. Unfortunately, we can't reach into the Obama library, or there's no way to get the Trump documents. But we would like to put those out into the public domain to spur a debate and at least have something more about how this issue that's not debated in Congress, the law that's ignored, all of this problem, show people that how this is handled at the very top level with this subversion of the entire Arms Export Control Act upon entering office by U.S. presidents, and get people to think a little bit about, well, why is it that they do that? Why do they feel so compelled that they'll sign these letters and issue them immediately. In the last case, apparently the Trump administration was really put off because they were in a bit of a crisis when the Israeli ambassador came in demanding a letter, but they complied. So we want people to see these letters and think about why these presidents feel that they have to do this and kind of reveal the overwhelming political pressure that they are faced with, both on the domestic lobbying side and by the Israelis, to, again, subvert some very important and intelligent laws that were put in place decades ago to condition U.S. aid to nuclear weapons states.
Is it safe to say that Israel is a nuclear renegade? They do not allow inspections. They do not in any way participate in the kinds of international inspections that, say, Iraq and Iran and other countries have gone through. They are simply out of the picture.
I guess you could say that. I get the, you know, there are major questions here, such as what really are their use doctrines? I mean, Cy Hirsch said back in the Samson Option book that their plan is the Samson Option, you know, that they would pull down the entire world with them if there was any sort of major threat. Well, people should understand, has that been updated? What do they do with their nuclear waste? Is there still testing going on? There's overwhelming evidence that the so-called Vela incident was a joint Israeli-South African nuclear test in the Indian Ocean back in 1974. What are they still testing? There are all sorts of questions about deployment, about waste, about policy that are commonly discussed in terms of every other nuclear power, but because of the way the United States has joined in this renegade behavior, again, in because we would argue of political pressures, none of this is debated. It's one of the biggest, and as Avner Cohen would say, worst-kept secrets in U.S. policymaking. Nobody's actually fooled, though. If we did do some polling back in 2014, and 63, almost 64% of Americans believe that Israel has nuclear weapons. So the American public is not fooled. But in terms of these promises and the impact that it should have on conditioning aid, nobody understands that, because there's always a huge court battle to get any of this type of information out. Fortunately, we have had some success in the past doing it, though.
Well, one of the reasons there's been a little bit of success is because you mentioned a man by the name of Vanunu.
Right.
Could you remind people who he is and what we know based on his experience?
Sure. Mordecai Vanunu was an Israeli technician who worked at the Dimona nuclear weapons production plant. He had a crisis of conscience, or maybe he just had a conscience that he wasn't suppressing in any way, and he took a number of high-resolution photographs of what was going on in the secret underground areas of Dimona, and took them and released them to the London Sunday Times in 1986, setting off a firestorm. He had, you know, the picture, the photographic evidence that the Israelis were working on advanced nuclear weapons, and that Dimona was not what they said it was, a fertilizer plant, a benign civilian nuclear facility, et cetera, et cetera. So Vanunu cracked the code. Unfortunately, he was lured back, in this case, I believe, to Italy, where he was kidnapped by a Mossad agent and returned to Israel, where he faced on and off solitary confinement for many, many years. He's kind of Israel's Julian Assange before Julian Assange was even born. There's no effort to get him any sort of platform to speak in the United States. He can't travel to the United States. Many people have tried to help him out unsuccessfully. He's a true hero for exposing this to the world. Did it have a lasting impact on U.S. policy? No.
What can we say about U.S. support? We know that the United States sends billions. They're just about to sign a budget, if they didn't already sign it, for an aid package for Israel, which was something like at least $38 billion or something like that, $33
right,
billion.
Dollars.
What can we say in terms of the U.S. role in helping to establish, to build, to support the nuclear weapons programs of Israel?
Well, there's no question that under the Eisenhower administration's Adams for Peace program, where the United States was giving away nuclear research facilities to developing countries, that the United States played a major role. We basically built with the Israelis their first civilian nuclear research facility called Sorek, and that facility has now, according to a Pentagon report we had released in 2015, been fully weaponized and is able to research advanced topics. Their nuclear infrastructure, thanks to U.S. support, has been built up and now looks vaguely like the parallel of the U.S.'s national laboratories and have a full capability for nuclear production. There's a report that we got out of the Pentagon, as I mentioned, that people can read about how advanced this is, called Critical Technology Assessment in Israel. This includes all the way up to hydrogen bomb research. So the United States, under Adams for Peace, was supposed to keep this from happening through ardent regulation. But what has passed is really a lax approach in which the flows of information, of technologies, even material, in the case of the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation diversion, have gone unpunished. And so the United States has treated the weaponization of the civilian nuclear program as kind of the equivalent of, you know, the neighbor borrowing the lawnmower and not returning it on time. Not that we're the only ones at fault. The French also helped out, in particular with the construction of Dimona. So the U.S. has been very problematic in not walking the talk, talking a lot about nonproliferation, pretending to be a champion of it, focusing on so-called threats like Iran while ignoring the elephant in the room.
We know that Israel has become a significant weapons exporter of weapons and technologies and ways to, if you will, suppress, repress resistance in countries around the world. Is there any indication that this also includes Israel helping other countries to get nuclear weapons, or the kind of dual-use technology that could lead up to the creation of nuclear weapons?
Well, Sasha Polakow-Saransky, who is a researcher of all places, the Council on Foreign Relations, actually obtained apartheid South Africa purchase orders for Israeli nuclear weapons back in the 80s and published those in a fascinating book and series of articles. So there's undeniable proof that they attempted to sell full turnkey weapon system before that regime fell. The CIA also suspected they were in cahoots with helping the Taiwanese possibly get a turnkey ability to go nuclear if they needed to. So the answer is yes. They're an expected proliferator or suspected proliferator with very compelling evidence that they've done that. There's recent speculation, which I don't find to be entirely credible, that they're possibly going to help the Saudis if they want to go nuclear. It doesn't seem very likely, but just the fact that nobody knows anything about this, that they're not a signatory to the NPT, raises many questions about whether, like the conventional weapon systems you mentioned, this is seen as a potential cash cow. One of the reasons for approaching South Africa was to keep the production line of their ballistic missiles open. They needed to reach some economies of scale and saw South Africa as a potential partner in helping to keep that industry going.
Wow. And finally, news, of course, in the news is Mickey Haley resigning as ambassador to the United Nations. Mickey Haley, one of the things she was proud of, most proud of, she said, was sort of granting, bringing more respect to Israel and more understanding about how they cannot be pushed into a corner or wiped off the mat by countries that want to get rid of Israel. How has Mickey Haley been? Has she mentioned anything about nuclear weapons? We've heard her talking a lot about weapons in Iran, weapons in North Korea, weapons in Russia. Anything about weapons in Israel?
No, of course not. I agree. She has had an incredible string as the UN ambassador and utterly delivering by the Trump administration everything the Israelis could possibly want. There's never been any indication. I think the overall idea, though, that this has helped the country is probably not going to last very long. Particularly as they begin to unveil this so-called peace plan toward the Palestinians, it's seen as so one-sided in the rest of the world that I don't think it's going to be long-lived.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there. But we thank you, Grant Smith, for the very good work. You're the director of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, doing good work. You have this lawsuit trying to find out some more information about the way in which the United States and other Westerners have supported one way or another the illegal. It's actually, let's call it a renegade international nuclear policy where the Israelis do not follow anybody other than their own wishes in terms of what they want to do with their weapons. So it's an important subject. We thank you for
absolutely
spending the time with us.
Thanks, Dennis. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye now.